Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
I'm Anna Reynolds, Head of Engagement for Cereals and Oilseeds at AHDB, and this episode is the first of two featuring Joel Williams. Joel's a leading plant and soil health educator, and we recently tapped into his wealth of experience by putting on seven meetings across England and Scotland that focused on farmer-to-farmer networking and highlighted steps to take on farm to unlock both additional profitability and resilience. Together with Laura Audrey, one of our knowledge exchange managers for dairy, we took some time out after a meeting in Devon to record his thoughts. In this episode, you'll hear him talk about systems approaches, measurement of soil and plant health, and nutrition. Joel began by explaining what systems thinking is and why it's so important.
I often somewhat use the analogy of that word holistic management, which I think is some terms that farmers are maybe a bit more familiar with. And we can kind of wrap our heads around that in terms of it suggesting that you're trying to manage the whole, looking much bigger picture and managing the whole system rather than breaking it down into individual little pieces of the puzzle. And there can be advantages to trying to manage whole systems that way. And that's really what systems thinking is all about. It's trying to look at how big complex things work understand them better at that macro level, which can help overall with some management decisions. And this differs from, say, a more reductionist approach. And this is kind of what we might typically talk about in the world of science and research, where we do reductionist science. We break things down into little pieces. We break complex things down into little pieces so that we study them individually at a level that's a bit more easier for us to do. And we hope that by understanding the individual pieces, we can rebuild the whole from that and have a better understanding of that whole. And there are real strengths to doing that. There's some real big advantages to the reductionist approach in terms of unpacking complex things and getting that insight. But there's also some negatives, and that's kind of what systems thinking tries to counterbalance, is that when we scale back up from the small to the big, sometimes we kind of lose a bit of resolution in doing that. And also sometimes whole systems operate in much bigger ways than the individual component parts.
In the Chathill meeting, Tom Fairfax mentioned the difference between complex systems and complicated systems. Is that what you were thinking as well? Is that quite a good description?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he gave that great analogy, didn't he? And trying to tease out a subtle difference between those. Something can be very complicated, but that kind of means, if you think about it in the context of a system, the analogy he gave is, you put something in and it might go through a very complicated process and complicated interactions, but what comes out is always the same. So that's different from something being complex, which is that there are many different interactions happening. And it is those multiple interactions, which means the outputs aren't always identical. Farming and soils and the way plants and animals and soils interact is definitely a very complex set of interactions.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you have some examples in mind for our listeners in terms of some of those interactions, how they play out in a field?
One example of one of the strengths of, say, the reductionist approach would be the field of plant nutrition. You know, we basically put plants into a laboratory, into a hydroponic solution culture, and we grew them all in the identical hydroponic solution with all of the essential nutrients that they need. And then we just remove one of those nutrients and we observe plant growth without that nutrient. And so we can then do that and then optimize that process by adding a small amount of that nutrient back in and then a little bit more, a little bit more. And we get this gradient of re-adding that nutrient of interest to observe how plants grow. When all of the other nutrients are the same, that we're just going to go from none and add a little bit, little bit, little bit of the one of interest. And we can observe exactly where optimum plant growth is. And then we can measure the analysis of that nutrient in the leaf tissue, for example, and identify that, okay, it seems to be that the plant requires roughly that amount of that nutrient in order to optimize its production. And that was a great example of then that reductionist science, that kind of we were controlling and manipulating each one little variable at a time, which helped us identify that. And then we were able to take that knowledge of plant nutrient requirements in the tissue. And then when we scale that back out into the field conditions and growing crops and plants all around the world in other different, all sorts of different contexts, we use that reductionist approach to kind of then help us much better understand plant nutrition. And no doubt it had a transformative impact on our understanding of how nutrients work, what they do, and roughly the levels that they that plants kind of require. But of course, you can't do that in isolation. That's all very good. What if we take that same understanding of the plant nutrients and those same plants, and we grow one of them in England and we grow one in Australia, for example, a very hot place? That's where you need, although the essential functions and things of those nutrients is sound and solid, then how the plants use those nutrients, the amounts that they need, of those various things to help them cope with maybe very cold conditions or very hot conditions can then change. So it's that context around that reductionist knowledge that we gain that then has to be added into the picture. And that's kind of really then what a systems approach would try to do and say, okay, well, now let's look at the bigger picture. Where is that plant in the landscape? Is it at a high point, low point? What's that soil type? Is it growing? What are the environmental conditions? How might these other factors change and interreact and relate to our fundamental knowledge? And that's the point. You've got to then put context into that foundational knowledge. And so that's then what we try to do out in general agronomy and things when we then look at the field conditions and look at the environmental conditions that that manage that. And it's really, that's the point, is that when you try to manage more holistically in that way, a bit more understanding the whole system rather than just the parts of the system, this is something called emergent properties. It's where things interact uniquely, and then there are unique characteristics that emerge from that interaction. And that's really the idea of 1 + 1 = 3. That's that idea, is that things that emerge from the system, the emergent property is not necessarily observable in a reductionist approach. If you're studying that one piece, it can't tell you about how that piece reacts with other pieces, and therefore how the overall system functions. And the classic example would be, often people talk about it as a car, or we could say a tractor, just because this is a farming podcast. just by understanding what the parts of a tractor do does not mean that you have a functional tractor. You know, it's how those parts are assembled, how they then interact with each other, which then makes the tractor usable, a function. If we lay out all the parts of the tractor on the ground and they're just sitting there, you can't use that. There's nothing you can do that. It's how those parts then are assembled and interact. And from that, something very unique, i.e. a usable, functional, drivable tractor emerges from those individual parts.
Another example you gave in the talks was of multifunctionality in agro ecosystems, and sort of how we combine perhaps imperfect tools. And just today, you gave a really good example of how oats and Phacelia and brassicas all have very different roles to play, say, in a cover crop situation. Mm-hmm. Do you want to expand a little bit on that?
Sure, yeah. Yep. So that's really the idea that, of course, different plants are, they're all different, and they have each unique specialities, different things that they do, different ways in which they grow. And that means that because of that, as they grow in soil, they can change lots of things of that soil. And that's the beauty of diversity, is that if we want to achieve many different things, many different goals, we can bring many plants together in order to achieve that multifunctionality. And so, yeah, there was a great study done here in the UK that showed black oats are really good at improving soil structure, particularly the porosity of the soil. The Phacelia was really good at encouraging fungi. Brassicas are known for being great nitrate scavengers. Legumes, of course, are very good for bringing in extra free nitrogen. So if we kind of want to achieve multiple benefits, multiple functions, then we can use all of those plants together. Why not have oats there for good soil structure? Why not have Phacelia there to stimulate fungi? Why not have some legumes there to bring more nitrogen in for the next crop in the rotation? And why not have some brassicas there to mop up any leftover nutrients that might be there from our previous crop? So we achieve multiple functions with multiple plant species. And that's really what is the benefit of then diversity, is achieving those multiple functions. And therefore we can drive greater system changes from that through those multiple functions all working together at once, rather than just one or the other.
How can farmers balance reductionist methods with systems-based approaches to optimize how they make decisions? And maybe what are the pitfalls that you've seen?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's not necessarily an easy thing to do either. There are pitfalls. Trying to manage holistically can be difficult. Again, there's many moving parts. And if you For example, if the idea of that reductionist approach is about trying to identify what's giving you the bulk of the benefit or doing most of the legwork, and we're trying to therefore pinpoint our management by knowing exactly what each part does and therefore maybe which one gives us the best bang for buck, so to speak. And that's of course a real benefit to that, but that's the point that the systems approach says. Well, of course, that's important. But what I'm going to do in terms of practically speaking, in terms of management, is what I'm going to do is not put all my eggs in one basket. I'm going to try multiple strategies, have a multi-pronged approach. And in doing that, I'm hedging my bets in order to to then drive that system performance. So there's real advantages to say that, okay, if one of those components fails, or if one of my strategies isn't really working, it's not so functional, it's not so good, not the best one for that soil type or that context, you've got others that help propping that up and keeping then the overall system afloat. And that's so then practically speaking, the ways in which they can do that is just to really try and use many tools, many different strategies all at once. And I know any of the scientists who might be listening will cringe at that kind of comment, because generally we're working to kind of understand which one is the best, how to get that bang for buck. But in the real world of practical farming, where I think farmers have got so many challenges alone to face, just even with the weather, for example, there's enough challenges there. So that's what the systems approach says. It's like, well, let's try and cut through all that nuance and say, here's some macro level management tools and management strategies at the bigger picture. Use many integrated strategies, many pieces of the puzzle. And overall, we aim to kind of hedge our bets there and keep the overall system performing. And, again, a good example of that would be something like the soil health principles. They're this overall guideline that says, okay, generally try and follow these rules as best you can, minimize soil disturbance, keep the soil covered, living roots, use diversity, integrate animals. These kind of macro level big picture principles can have great applicability. And sure, because they provide these overarching rules or guidelines to help farmers kind of deal with the complexity underneath that, but actually in a way make it a bit more simpler in terms of macro level. And I know some farmers, may not follow all of those principles, but it's about doing as many of them as you can, as often as you can, the ones that are relevant to your context, etc. So it provides you then with some of the bigger guidelines to try and make the complexity of that a bit easier and make it a bit more tangible and more practical.
Absolutely. And I suppose one example of that is the HDB Soil Health Scorecard, which sort of tries to pick out the physical, biological, and chemical aspects that as a farmer you can look at, you can measure, and get a really pretty good general overview of the health of your soil and whether something needs to be looked at a little bit closer or whether the benchmark is fine. But there's something that you mentioned earlier today, that actually this physical, chemical, biological is not the whole picture. And I think you talked about how plants come into that trio. Do you want to just talk about that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. When plants grow in soils, they also change those soils, influence those chemical, physical, and biological properties. So when we talk about soil health from the bottom up, that idea that, oh, I must make my soil healthy. Here's the scorecard, here's those metrics. I've got to optimize my pH, optimize my nutrient availability, improve structure. I've got to do this, I've got to do that to make my soil healthy. And then healthy plants will grow. And this is a little bit the opposite way, saying, well, actually, because plants photosynthesize and bring carbon into the system, and because they grow in that soil and they also influence that soil, chemistry, physics, and biology, we can also use plants to change soils. And everyone would be very familiar. That's the essence of what is a green manure. We grow a green manure to improve the soil, to influence that soil. So soil health is kind of both a bottom up and top down, and they're both important, and you kind of need both of them. And that's where things like the scorecard system that you've developed is trying to narrow down all of those many, many variables and possibly things that we can monitor and manage and say, okay, which are the ones that maybe give us our kind of bang for buck, and just try to kind of create, at least narrow the goalposts a little to make it a little bit easier on where to focus and help us kind of chart our direction forward. But I think it's a really important point that you know, there's no soils without plants, there's no plants without soils. And so we have to really consider them together as one unit. And I think it's very important that we bring plants into that discussion. And that, practically speaking, the two tools that we can use to then manage plants to change soils or to help influence the soil health would be plant nutrition and plant species diversity. And plant nutrition is important because it's the essential nutrients that catalyze photosynthesis and drive that pump, carbon pump of getting carbon into the plant and then down into the soil. So nutrients are key. But then with the diversity of plants, then as we discussed earlier, they provide many different functions and benefits to the soil. So that diversity can also help to accelerate changes, unique changes in that soil health transition.
Brilliant. I think we're going to keep coming back to this theme that diverse systems are resilient systems, and farming is complex and there's a lot of interactions, and we're really just picking at the surface of the potential of what's there, which I think is fascinating. But flipping that on the side, actually, and another kind of topic that comes up, I think came up a few times in our meetings, was around the soil health measures. And there is a very complicated rather than complex field where we've got Olbrecht, we've got Haney, we've got sap versus tissue, fungal to bacterial ratio, microscopy DNA, we've got all of those things. I don't know whether soil health scorecard that's been looked at and sort of reduced into some measures that are really, really simple we can actually use. But there is still a whole world of measurement out there. And I think one of the questions we had, particularly at Chat Hill meeting, was what are the top three? What do you think?
You know, I do think that I do lean a little bit towards some of those metrics and indicators that farmers can measure themselves in field. I do, of course, I value the lab-based tests and measurements. They can tell us things in much more finer detail than what we can with just a spade. But, you know, for everyday, day-to-day kind of use on farm, when farmers are out in their fields and they can quickly just check some of these things, doing some kind of baselining and benchmarking and all of that kind of thing, I do really value some of those in-field metrics and guidelines. And, you know, I think one of the well-known ones and the kind of popular ones in recent times, and I think rightly so, is the infiltration test. I think this is just very simple to say that, okay, we can quickly check how well water is infiltrating, and that it tells us by default a lot about the soil physical condition. And if we have good infiltration, therefore we have good soil physics, that means we, for starters, we have a good structure there, a good physical environment for organisms to grow. So if we have poor structured, heavy compacted soil, it's not going to be a soil that, for example, the organisms are going to survive and thrive in. So firstly, if we have good structure, we can by default then say, okay, well, at least we have a better physical environment for then the biology to function. And if then they're functioning, they're the ones going to be doing a lot of that nutrient cycling and therefore influencing the soil chemistry. So I think with good reason, infiltration is one of those kind of popular infield ones. And I think that it does give you a good indication overall of that soil function beyond just the physical thing you're doing there. It does give you a general indication of biology and chemistry. So I think that's a great one. And I am a fan of the VEST test, which I know was in your scorecard too. And again, that's a very similar reason. It's something that farmers can do, you know, right there in their fields. And if they just want to do a bit of a relative comparison to a good field and a poor field, or the high point, low point, or a good part of the field, or hedgerow versus, you know, native area versus productive area. We can get these relative comparisons of some of how the soils are looking, et cetera, with that visual examination. And then I think when farmers are maybe doing that kind of a thing on two different fields with maybe two different management strategies, it can kind of help them steer the way of their management decisions. Which way should they be going visually? Which soils are starting to respond to different management strategies? What's looking structurally, physically better? So I think the VEST one is a very, very good one as well. And I guess the other one, which is a bit of everyone's favorite, is earthworm counts. I think that, you know, it's just, and again, you know, all of these are imperfect. It's just about kind of trying to choose one or a couple and be consistent with them over time. So I think that, again, the earthworm count is a nice, simple, easy and standardized methodology that, you know, that can be used all around the world, but especially from a farmer's point of view, is to compare field to field and get those relative comparisons.
And actually it's really interesting that you pick out all the things that the farmers can do in their field. I heard somebody say recently that the first bit of metal that hits the ground after harvest is spade, and I think that's, you know, this quite right, I think.
Good one.
In Newbury, we were asked about sap analysis in particular, and whether in-field sap ion meters were a viable option for farmers. Is that something that you've looked at closely, something that you've experienced?
And I think, again, like every tool, it has strengths and weaknesses. And those in-field sap meters are, I think, useful primarily, again, to make relative comparisons. I think that's where they really come into their own. So, for example, if you're comparing two fields with two different management strategies, or you're going to apply a treatment, a foliar spray treatment, for example, you can then use those infield meters to compare a control with a treatment, or compare field A with B to see that plant nutrient status. And there's a question mark over how exactly well calibrated and reliable the numbers are. And that's where I think it doesn't matter if you're doing the relative comparisons. That's where it doesn't matter you're comparing it to a control versus a treatment. Did the treatment, was it effective? Did it increase the nutrient level? And the beauty of those meters is that you get an immediate rapid turnaround. So you get the reading right there and then in the field. You don't have to wait for a week or so for the results from the lab to come back to you. So again, there's those tools. There's only a handful of nutrients that you can use to measure with those tools. So it doesn't give you everything, all of the essential nutrients. And so that's its limitation. There's only maybe five or so nutrients there that you can measure. So that's where, again, maybe a lab test would have the edge also, because it can do a lot more of the essential nutrients that plants need. So you know, there's strengths and weaknesses to both of those. The lab one's going to cost you more money. It's going to take you a bit more time. The field ones are immediate. They're quick. But they're, you know, so they're kind of different tools in that regard, used for different things. But I think that both of them have total applicability. But yes, I think that some of those infield ones, that's part of their appeal and advantage, is the kind of the rapid turnaround and how you can kind of use them to guide your treatment effects, so to speak.
At another meeting, I think in Ripon, we had a question about fungal to bacteria ratio. Actually, I've heard that question a few times during the tour. Is that a helpful measure in your view?
Yeah, it's a good question. Of course, there's a lot of interest in that one in recent times. And yeah, I think it is a good indicator, yes. It's also not without its challenges. So for example, the fungal to bacterial ratio is quite dependent on the method you use to measure it. And so most farmers, I think, are using the microscopy method, trying to kind of look under the microscope and then compare. And that generally actually is a method that gives you a bit more fungal counts than, say, compared to some of the other molecular tools that we can use to measure fungal to bacterial ratios. And those tools is basically where we look and identify specific molecules inside the cell walls and things that identify it as either a bacteria or fungi. And so when you use a different technique like that, you can then get very different numbers of what the fungal to bacterial balance is. So that's one of the great challenges of that. And the idea of the fungal bacterial ratios really comes from primarily ecological studies. This is something we observe a lot in natural systems. It's often talked about as a useful guide or metric. And some do question whether it has as much applicability in an agricultural context. It has my support. As a general rule, I agree that many of our agricultural fields are a bit lacking in fungi. This is certainly any soils that are cultivated. This disrupts the fungal hyphae. So I think any tillage-based systems are definitely going to be somewhat compromised on fungi. And generally speaking, they're a bit more fussy and sensitive organisms than bacteria. They're a little less hardy, so to speak. So they're a bit more sensitive to maybe some of the other nutrients or pesticides and things that we may be using. So I think as a general notion, look, I do support that we do need to be building more fungal levels in our soils. And so I think, yeah, for many farmers that have a microscope, that have the time and inclination to kind of maybe have a look at their soils and see and gauge how much fungal to bacterial amounts are there, I think it can be a It can be a useful tool, yes. Again, it's one of those ones I would put in the bag as one of my tools, but I wouldn't be doing it maybe as the sole sole indicator. And a perfect example of why would that be would be that, just as an example, what if you have extremely low levels of fungi and extremely low levels of bacteria, but you might have a good fungal to bacterial ratio, but they're both just down through the floor kind of thing. So, you know, there's a certain threshold of activity or level that you want to see first, which I think is much more important. And then if you get that, okay, maybe we can be more specific about what is the balance between them.
I think that brings us on to my next question quite neatly, actually, which was about the importance of making what you already have work for you on your farm before you consider perhaps biological amendments or compost tea, some of these other things that have become really quite popular recently. When do you decide that you need an input?
Many soils do have a lot of nutrients in them, in the total form. A small fraction is what's plant available, and a much larger fraction is there, present in soils, but just not plant available, just locked up. And so that's part of that argument that says, okay, if we can improve soil health, if we can use plants and biology, the organisms in the soil, to unlock some of those total nutrients. And this is, I think, a little less relevant for those very light sandy soils. Those light sandy soils don't have as much total nutrients in them, but certainly some of the medium and fine textured soils, heavier clay soils, etc., they do. And that's then the argument that says, okay, why don't we just leverage what's already there? How do we just use the fertility that is already present in our soils? And then maybe we would look at, as a secondary process, some of those other additives and things to layer on top as, you know, cherry on the cake kind of thing. But I think in terms of leveraging that fertility and as a baseline foundational kind of strategy, that's again where things like the conservation ag principles or soil health principles are very useful, because they give that overall guideline to just try and help maximize what's there already, maximize the health of that system, the function of that system, to then make sure what's there is cycling and available and functioning. Following some good soil health principles, those types of practices is what's going to help you get the most out of your soil to begin with. And especially it's about keeping that soil covered and having living plants and photosynthesis and that carbon pump, bringing carbon into the system to then drive that potential of that soil. So again, I do think that the living roots or the green cover piece of that puzzle is particularly important for getting the most out of what's already there. And then, yeah, on top of that, you know, if farmers want to use other inputs and additives on top of that, I think that's great. Using things like organic manures, compost, some of these other more less common things that are a bit of interest now these days, as you said, biofertilizers, biostimulants, some of these things. But I think that really, as the foundation, it's got to be start with working with your soil at that foundational level, principle level, and then you'd move on to some of those other things with those little icing on the cake type things. And I think that you've got things like biofertilizers are, again, a bit of a hot topic these days, adding microbes, whether or not we need to add microbes to soils, or is there enough already there, that whole kind of debate. And I think that's where, again, I agree that just take care of those who are there already. That should be the primary focus. You know, feed the organisms that are there, and that's where photosynthesis and carbon coming into the system will do that. And then as a secondary, if you want to be adding new microbes into the system, again, I would encourage people to be doing that in ways in which they are the ones manufacturing those microbes on their own farms. And by that, I just mean making compost, for example. So at least you've got some of the native organisms in that native environment who are adapted to that environment, to then culture those, and then you might add that compost to the soil or make a compost extract out of that, and then add those additives to the seed or into the furrow. So again, it's that point that, okay, I am adding biology, but I'm still trying to culture and use ones that are local and a bit more adapted. And then as a, I think, third and final piece of that puzzle, I would consider, you know, some of the commercial products. I think that should be the order that farmers think about it. Take care of who's already there. Make local ones if you're going to introduce biology and resort to things from a lab last.
I'm Anna Reynolds, and you're listening to HDB's Food and Farming podcast featuring plant and soil health educator Joel Williams. Joel was over recently for a series of meetings organised by HDB. We've already heard Joel talk about systems approaches and measurement of soil and plant health. He also chatted to us about nutrition, starting with nitrogen use efficiency.
The traditional view, the traditional thinking about nitrogen use efficiency is really more specifically should be defined as nitrogen uptake efficiency. And so the classic view says, well, based on how much of a fertilizer that I apply, how much of that ended up in the plant, ended up in the crop or the pastures, you know, whatever it might be. So that's normally how we think about it. So we want to try and improve the efficiency by applying fertilizers, and we want to try and get as much of that fertilizer actually into the plant, because any fertilizer that we don't get into the plant is then potentially lost from the system. And nitrogen is a very, very bad culprit of this. It has a very high tendencies to be very, very leaky. It can leach through the soil as nitrates and off gas into the air as ammonia or nitrous oxides. So of course we want to try and minimize the losses is what that's all about. And so therefore we want to maximize the uptake. So that's the nitrogen uptake efficiency. And that's kind of how most people think about nitrogen use efficiency. But there's another definition which I was introducing and talking about in the lecture series, which was the nitrogen utilization efficiency. And this definition is really about saying, once you get nitrogen into the plant, how much biomass or how much yield, how much biomass can I produce per unit of nitrogen once that nitrogen is in the plant? So that's the nitrogen utilization efficiency. And when we ask that question and define nitrogen in that way, we then by default have to unpack this, yes, this complex topic of plant nutrition. And there's a lot of nuanced details in that one. But the point of that is really just to say that there are different forms of nitrogen that the plants can make use of, and some of those are more or less efficient, or the plant can make use of them more or less efficiently. When plants take up nitrogen, they are you taking up these, say, inorganic forms like nitrate or ammonium. We often apply ammonium nitrate, so the plant is taking up those inorganic forms. And when I say inorganic, I mean nutrients without any carbon. And once carbon gets attached to and bound, this becomes then organic forms of nutrients. Carbon is the stuff of life. Living things are all made of carbon. And so once you attach carbon to nutrients, they become organic forms of those nutrients. So when the plant takes up, say, for example, ammonium or nitrate, it doesn't really want those. It wants organic forms. It wants to turn those building blocks, those forms of nitrogen, into useful things for plants, like amino acids, like proteins. So the plant will convert those inorganic forms into organic forms. And it does that to build its body, to build protein. Many farmers are interested in building protein. That would be an example of an organic form of nitrogen. But the plant does other things. It might build chlorophyll, use it to build its DNA. Nitrogen is used for all sorts of various organic molecules. But I think protein is a good example that many farmers could relate to, because we can value that quality of the protein in that plant. So then we have this conversation about nitrogen utilization efficiency. That really means that when the plant uses, for example, nitrate, it has to use a lot of energy to convert that nitrate into protein. If the plant takes up some ammonium, it also has to use a lot of energy to convert that into protein. But ammonium takes a little less energy than nitrate. So nitrate is the most energetically expensive form of nitrogen for plants to use. So in a way, we could argue that we want to minimize the amount of nitrates. And I'm not saying we could use none, but they are, because they're the least efficient form, meaning they drain the most photosynthetic carbon in order to turn them into amino acids and proteins, we could say that we want to have them maybe minimized. And that differs from, say, the organic forms of nitrogen, like amino acids, like proteins. It turns out the plants can take those up also directly from the soil. The plants can take up amino acids, these organic molecules, from the soil. These are energy-saving forms of nitrogen because they're already organic forms. They've already got carbon embedded in them. And that means they drain less photosynthetic carbon to make use of them because they're already organic. They're already functional. So in this point about nitrogen utilization efficiency, it turns out that these organic fractions, amino acids, little chains of amino acids called peptides, or even larger chains of those, the more complete proteins, all of these organic forms have the highest efficiency, utilization efficiency, and that energy then can be saved for other growth processes, to grow deeper roots, to till more, to fill bigger grain, or et cetera, et cetera. So in that sense, farmers, and this is true if they're cereal or grain farmers, or also our livestock, and I think pasture farmers, they'll appreciate the importance of good quality protein in the diet of the animal. I think they'll appreciate the importance of that. That really means that wherever we can integrate some of the organic forms of nitrogen, so this is using organic amendments as much as possible, organic manures, of course, composts, and even there are many kind of commercial amino acid type products and things on the market these days. For example, fish hydrolysate, something like that. It's taking wasted fish products and then digesting them, breaking them down to extract all of those valuable amino acids, these organic forms that are very favorable for plant growth. So just as an example, I think there's a lot of opportunity to upcycle many of our kind of agricultural waste products and extract some of these amino acids out of those, what generally might be considered waste products, and reuse them in a better way. And so if we can integrate the application of those or the use of these organic forms, these are the most efficient and actually build protein, quality protein in the most effective and efficient way.
What is the role of other nutrients in nitrogen utilization efficiency?
Some of the other trace elements, for example, they help the plant use that nitrogen more effectively. Those trace elements influence the conversion or the protein synthesis process. And if those trace elements are deficient, then the plant will not be able to use the nitrogen there as efficiently and build as better quality proteins. So that's why they, plant nutrition also needs to extend beyond basics of just N, P, and K, where we apply our P and K and then we manage N. Well, the trace elements are very important. Probably many farmers listening might have said, well, I tried some trace elements. I didn't really see maybe much of a yield response from that. And that's a fair comment. Trace elements don't always drive yield so visually, so to such an extent. But what they do is help to improve the efficiency of that conversion and utilization of nitrogen. So they do help to make out the nitrogen inputs that we do use to improve the efficiency of those. And I think that's where they have a very underappreciated role as well.
Now, Joel, you did touch just briefly on the different forms of nitrogen in organic and sort of organic forms. But in a farm context, can you sort of elaborate more about how these can be best used?
Yeah, sure. So if we could use things like compost or, manures, that's a way to apply, or other organic-based kind of waste materials. That's a great way to apply them. And there's many benefits beyond just the organic nitrogen to those. You know, compost and manures have lots of other great things in them too. But yes, they also have some of those organic forms of nitrogen. And of course, you've got things like, slurry for our dairy friends. They would have slurry material there, which is also a great source of a lot of organic amino acids and things. I think, of course, the problem with slurry is generally we apply it at much too high rates and it's just overburdens too much at once. But I think that there's a lot of opportunities for better, more efficient slurry management. Such as using microbes, slurry bugs, these types of things to actually eat all of those nutrients in that manure and convert them into these organic forms, get the biology, bacteria, etc., to eat all those nutrients and put it in their bodies. And that actually helps to stabilize the nutrients, make them not so hot and leaky. And so I think slurry is a good stuff for soil, but we just generally over-apply it. And I think it's that's where it can then be problematic. But I think slurry is a good example of that. And then I gave some examples of, there are more and more commercial products out there at the moment. You can buy in these amino acids and that kind of thing. There's a bit of interest in those. And I think that where, practically speaking, these have a lot of relevance is the combination of organic with inorganics. There is a synergy there with the two working together. And I think that just one other subtle point here is that some of these amino, this idea of kind of applying organic forms of nitrogen, amino acids like this, They do have a particular benefit when they are foliar applied, because when you apply them onto the leaf, you're going to get them into the plant. The challenge with putting organic amendments or amino acids and things down into the soil is that there's a lot of other hungry mouths down there, all of the bacteria and fungi and all of the other microlife down there. When you put some of these things down into the soil, that's not all bad. There's just a lot more competition for access to them. So the microbes are generally going to eat first and gobble them up. And that's not all bad, because then those microbes will grow and die, and the cycle will continue, and they will release those organic forms. So that's fine. But in terms of some of these direct benefits to plant growth from the nitrogen use efficiency and building those organic forms, there are advantages specifically to foliar applying them so that they actually enter the plant and not get gobbled up by someone else first.
Well, we're sort of increasingly looking more at soil organic matter, and that came up quite a lot about how we could be increasing soil organic matter on our farms with different soil types. But what is its role and contribution in aiding plant and animal health?
Yeah, I mean, we could say that organic matter is kind of one of those master metrics, isn't it, of soil health. If we talk about this conversation about soil health and trying to identify what the key metrics are, often soil carbon, soil organic matter would be, you know, right up there or the centerpiece of soil health, so to speak. And it does a lot of really great things for soil. It's feed, it's carbon, so it's fuel, so it feeds all of the organisms. So organic matter helps to glue and kind of provide carbon to stick soil particles together, so it does improve physical characteristics and the physical resilience of that soil. And then, as it is decomposing and being cycled, it's releasing nutrients and providing nutrients as well. When we say soil organic matter, that's also a good source of some of those organic forms of nitrogen that we were also just talking about. As soil organic matter cycles, it is releasing some of those amino acids and proteins and things as they all get digested and break down. So it's also an example of another source of organic nitrogen. That helps the wheels turn. That's what soil organic matter is so good for. If you've got a sandy soil, soil organic matter is good to hold moisture, hold nutrients. If you've got a heavy clay soil, soil organic matter is good to improve the physical properties of that. It's kind of like the master healer, so to speak. And no matter kind of what your problem or challenge is, it provides a great buffer and an improvement of the soil quality, the soil function, to kind of help deal with all sorts of adverse conditions.
And do you think we can put a monetary value on soil organic matter?
Soil organic matter is one of those funny things. It's a little bit like soil health in itself. Sometimes it's very hard to economically quantify the benefits of it. Sometimes it's very hard to get direct economic benefits to say, well, how much is this really helping me? And I think soil health is a bit like that. And I think soil organic matter is a little bit like that too. It does a lot of really important things, but if you tried to boil it down and say, well, is this going to actually improve my production, my profitability directly? It gets very fuzzy there, murky. It's very difficult to kind of really pinpoint that. But obviously we know that indirectly it helps so many other aspects of the soil function, and that ultimately helps to drive better nutrient supply for plants and therefore healthier animals eating those more nutrient-dense plants. So I think it's one of those kind of master variables, really, isn't it? A master metric that generally, you know, the more you have in the soils, the better. But that's a broad generalization, of course, because we have things like our peat soils and muck soils, which when you have too much in there, it starts to be a problem too. But the general, I think that we can be honest that most agricultural soils are a bit deficient in carbon and could do with more.
Yeah, and you did talk about the broad range of soils, and here in the UK we do have such a broad spectrum, heavy clay soils down here to sandy soils to peat soils, and leaning it back to that sort of, I guess, profitability, we're always looking at what we can get from availability from our soils. So how can we kind of increase what we've already got in our soils, the nutrition in our soils, and increase the availability of these?
It's all about biology to unlock those nutrients. And when I say biology, I mean plants and organisms in the soil. Plants start the process because of the photosynthesis, as we talked about earlier. They're the ones bringing the carbon, the fuel, the energy in. And then it's those, particularly the microorganisms, but through to the insects and things at a slightly more macro level, who are then very good at feeding on that carbon, using that carbon for energy to grow their bodies and feed and interact with all the other organisms. And as they do that, they have very good abilities to solubilize nutrients from the soil, make them available to the plant. So that's really the essence of the relationship between plant and soil. It's really about trading carbon, because all of the life in the soil can't photosynthesize like plants can. So plants give away their carbon, and those organisms that live in that nutrient-rich soil but don't have very much carbon, they will get nutrients from the soil and deliver that back to the plant. And yeah, many of the organisms in the soil, particularly the microbes, they're very good. They exist in such genetic diversity, such incredible biodiversity. With that diversity comes a lot of genetic diversity, and with that genetic diversity comes all sorts of genes that code for all sorts of very interesting exudates and metabolites and things that those microbes produce. And so microbes have a lot of tools in their toolbox in order to solubilize phosphorus or solubilize iron or all sorts of very, very specific things that they can, specific chemicals they can release to help drive that nutrient cycling. So really, in terms of leveraging the fertility that's already there in those soils, it's really all about feeding the life in the soil, and through their growth and death cycles, through their external digestion, all the substances and things that they leak out into the system, this is how their nutrients get solubilized off the soil particles, incorporated into their bodies, and then those microbes die and those nutrients are released and ultimately shared back with the plants.
Are there any other ways that we can get that soil biology to work for us and help us access a total pool of nutrition in our soils?
It could be, of course, the use of cover crops in order to unlock some of those nutrients, and companion crops that can also help to increase nutrient cycling and leverage that fertility, through to having a perennial in the arable rotation. So perennials are very good at deeper roots, scavenging nutrients from the soil, capturing those nutrients, preventing losses. So a perennial phase, and of course, livestock integration then goes hand in glove with that. So using animals and the grasses and that pasture animal interaction to help drive deep root production through the grazing management, deep root production, therefore good nutrient extraction from the soil, and cycle those nutrients around through the animal, through the manure, etc. So I think livestock integration is also a great way to use perennial plants to also leverage that fertility out of the soil. I'm encouraged to hear that we're having more somewhat more positive conversations about trees in the landscape. I think that they, and trees and shrubs and things, I mean, like we do with hedgerows already, you know, many animals will have a browse on some of those different plants. And yeah, I agree with your point that trees and deeper rooted hedges and things, yeah, they can be accumulating very specific minerals and specific nutrients that can really support animal health.
And that was plant and soil health expert Joel Williams wrapping up the discussion on nutrition. I am Anna Reynolds, Head of Engagement for Cereals and Oilseeds at AHDB. Also taking part in a discussion with Joel was my colleague Laura Audrey, a Knowledge Exchange Manager for Dairy. Well, that may be it for this episode of the Food and Farming podcast, but this is the first of a two-part special with Joel, so look out for part two, which is due to be released before the end of the year. Amongst the topics next time are diversity as a defence, diversity as a threat, and productivity versus profitability. Until then, thanks for listening.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.